This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Not all the books, movies, and music that we love are paragons of refinement and subtlety. In recognition of that, we're calling this week Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy. All the movies, music, and books we talk about this week will come under at least one of those categories, big, bombastic, brassy, or trashy, and we admit we're fans of all the stuff we'll be talking about. We begin our series with a couple of films that help define the word big, Godzilla and King Kong.
What are you going to do?
I'll build a raft to float him to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
A scene from the 1933 film King Kong. That was Robert Armstrong as Carl Denham, the producer who journeys to Skull Island in the Indian Ocean to capture the giant ape and bring him to New York to star in a nightclub spectacle. There are many things that make King Kong great: the special effects, the image of the giant ape climbing the Empire State Building, the great score by Max Steiner, and the piercing screams of Fay Wray, who died earlier this month at the age of 96. In 1999, I spoke to film historian Rudy Belmer, who had just written the liner notes for a CD of the soundtrack of King Kong, including dialogue and music. Belmer's other books include Inside Warner Brothers and Behind the Scenes. Here's the opening title music from King Kong. Belmer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry. Bum, bum, bum. It doesn't sound as good when I do it as when Max Steiner did it.
Well, he wrote it.
Yeah.
What would you say the importance of Max Steiner's score is for King Kong? I mean, I love the score for this.
It's a wonderful score, and of course, he was a pioneer, certainly in doing sound motion picture scores. But if you can imagine that picture, if you turn the sound off when you're watching a cassette or seeing it on television, and you turn the sound off during the big sequences, certainly in the jungle and on top of the Empire State Building and so forth, and you realize how much the sound elements contribute to the success of that film, not only the sound effects that Murray Spivak created out of roars and grunts and groans and what have you, that he manufactured, but also the wonderful dramatic values that Max Steiner brought to it. Because, you know, at that time, when he was beginning to score that in late 1932, music throughout, in terms of a underscoring, was not prevalent. It was shortly after sound came in, and the emphasis was on dialogue. In fact, background scoring was relatively sparse. But Max rose to the occasion, and fortunately, Marion C. Cooper was a staunch advocate, and so was David Selznick, who was the executive producer at RKO Radio at the time. And they said, yes, we want a full-blooded score, and it certainly became that. And he, you know, he made that thing work from a dramatic standpoint.
I love the score, but I find something very amusing about it, which is that although it's set on this island, Skull Island, the music is really very European and nothing like what would have been heard in the region at that time. And I'll play this scene in a moment, but, you know, when they first get to the island, when the American film crew first gets to the island and they're watching this, you know, native ritual,
Yes.
The natives are chanting Kong, Kong, Kong. And there's this like march behind them as a kind of precursor of Kong's footsteps that will be marching toward, yes, his, toward his prey. And the march is a very European form, and the brass instruments playing it are so European. And yet this defines a kind of, you know, South Sea Island or African kind of Hollywood sound.
That's true. Well, of course, Max and everybody else associated with this picture knew we were dealing with a fantasy here. It's a total fantasy. A more, as Cooper said, a more illogical picture could never have been thought up. And it is illogical if you stop and examine it from that standpoint. But the music, you know, they weren't saying, well, wait a minute, we have to get something that's indigenous to this area. We have to be authentic. We have to be like a documentary. And, you know, it was full reign of the imagination. And, of course, Max composed in a full Wagnerian manner, you know, with leitmotifs and with all kinds of percussive effects that could be used. And he just went all out. And the aspect of credibility, you forget about that because, once again, we're dealing in the world of fantasy, the ultimate world of fantasy.
Well, let's hear that scene where the film crew is observing this native ritual where the natives are chanting Kong.
What do you suppose is happening?
Oh, they're up to some of their heathen tricks. But don't go rushing out to sea.
All right, but isn't it exciting?
Sure. I wish we'd left you on the ship.
Oh, I'm so glad you did.
Wait, easy now. Wait till I see what goes on.
What a show. Hey, Skipper, come here and get a load of this. Ever see anything like that before in your life?
Pure musical delirium. really
and
it.
frenzy yeah, and delirium. Yeah. I think that would be a good team.
And that's from the soundtrack of King Kong, which has just been released on CD. My guest Rudy Belmer wrote the liner notes for it. Well, the other memorable sounds in King Kong include, of course, Fay Wray's screams and the roar of Kong himself. Let's start with Fay Wray's screams. You know, in the movie, the Carl Denham character, the character who wants to, like, wrangle Kong and bring him back for a nightclub act, he says to the Fay Wray character, he's kind of like teaching her how to scream, and he says, okay, pretend you're screaming for your life, which, of course, she later has to do. Do you know what kind of advice Fay Wray was given about how she should scream?
Well, the interesting thing is that, of course, if she had done as much screaming when they were shooting this film as it appears to be, she would have been hoarse on the fourth day of shooting. Most of her screams were post-recorded. After the picture finished shooting, they took her into a sound booth, and she did wild screams. And they used those screams, so fortunately she had one major screaming session, which once again was after the film finished shooting.
And of course, King Kong has a very memorable roar. What do you know about how that was achieved?
Well, a remarkable man by the name of Murray Spivak, who was the head of the sound department at RKO Radio Pictures at the time, he was confronted with this film, you know, and thought, what can I do? It can't sound like some animal. It has to be a distinctive sound. So he went out and he recorded the roar of a lion and the roar of a tiger, and he was playing things at different speeds and playing them backwards and then combining them. And then even for some of Kong's grunts and things, he recorded himself doing in a little a megaphone-type deal. So the sound is a kind of a combination of many things. It sounds like a roar, but it's not a roar that you can identify, which, of course, is what he wanted to do. But by altering the speeds of the recordings and taking two different animals and overlapping them, of course, you can do all kinds of things.
Well, why don't we hear a nice scene with plenty of screams and roars? And this is, I believe, the first time we actually see Kong. Fay Wray is tied at the stake during another one of these ceremonies. And this scene starts with the chief, played by Noble Johnson.
Karatane Kong. Otarave Ramo Kong. Wasaba Sanamaka. Otarave Ramo Kong.
We'll talk more about King Kong with film historian Rudy Belmer after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film historian Rudy Belmer. He wrote the liner notes for a CD of the King Kong soundtrack. Now, you know, Carl Denham is the character who's the American promoter determined to capture Kong so he can create a crowd-pleasing spectacle, you know, back in New York. And I want to play the scene where he explains why he needs a beautiful actress for the film that he eventually wants to build around Kong.
You never had a woman in any of your other pictures. Why do you want one in this?
Because the public, bless them, must have a pretty face to look at.
Well, Mr. Denham, why not take a picture in a monastery?
Yeah. Makes me sore. I go out in sweat blood to make a swell picture, and then the critics and the exhibitors all say, if this picture had love interest, it would gross twice as much. All right. The public wants a girl, and this time I'm going to give them what they want.
I don't know where you're going to get her.
You think I'm going to give up just because you can't find me a girl with a backbone? Listen, I'm going out and make the greatest picture in the world, something that nobody's ever seen or heard of. You'll have to think up a lot of new adjectives when I come back.
Where are you going?
I'm going out and get a girl for my picture, even if I have to marry one.
Well, Carl Denham is certainly determined to do anything he needs to do to make this picture. Any comparisons you could make between Carl Denham and the real director of King Kong, Marion Cooper?
Well, there are a lot of comparisons because Marion Cooper was, to a large extent, Carl Denham. And Ernest Schoedsack, his partner, who was the co-director, was, to a certain degree, the Bruce Cabot character.
That's the love interest of Fay Wray.
The love interest of Fay Wray, who was the first mate on the junket. And Ruth Rose was Mrs. Schoedsack, and she wrote the final dialogue script. And Cooper and Schoedsack had been partners for a long time. They had done a very important documentary called Grass back in 1925, and then they did another one called Chang in 1927, where they were actually over in Siam, which was called then and later Thailand, and shot there up in the jungles with the tigers and the elephants and so forth. And they were really adventurous folk. I mean, back then, this was a big deal. And the entire company was Cooper and Schoedsack. They shot their own footage. They directed it. They set it up. They got to know the natives. So this kind of an expedition, of course, was taken to its fantasy element once again by King Kong, which was a conception of Marion Cooper's. When he was a young boy of about six, his great uncle gave him a copy of a book that was written in the middle of the 19th century called Explorations and Adventures in Equatorial Africa by a man by the name of Paul Duchaillou. And in it, he's describing these terrifying gorillas, which, of course, years later we've come to realize is not the case. But this was before anybody had really gotten to study the gorillas. And this electrified Cooper as a little kid. He said, and he told me this back in the 60s, he said, from that point on, I knew I wanted to be an explorer. Well, he did want to become an explorer, and he combined exploring with motion picture making and then later on with aviation. And he was an incredible character.
Cooper refused to use a man in a gorilla suit for King Kong. And so they went with, you know, the puppet and stop time animation. Why didn't he want to use a man in a gorilla suit? It certainly would have been a lot easier.
Well, he felt that this had to be something different. And, of course, there had always been these men running around in gorilla suits in all kinds of movies that were made in the 20s and early 30s. And, you know, that was fine. But he wanted to do something special. And when he saw, over at RKO, Willis O'Brien, who was the chief technician, working on some stop-motion material for a picture called Creation, which was never made, and he saw these dinosaurs, he thought, wait a minute. Nobody's going to finance me during the Depression to go over to Africa and shoot a gorilla and then bring the gorilla to Komodo and so forth and so forth. When he saw that process at RKO, he thought, wait a minute, this is the way to do King Kong. So he wanted to do it via this stop motion, but to hedge his bet, he also had a huge full-size bust of Kong constructed and a hand and arm of Kong constructed, and a foot, so that for some shots, for example, when he's holding Fay Wray in his hand, you've got the hand. When you see an occasional close-up of the head, it's this big, oversized Kong. But he did not want to shoot a man in a gorilla suit. He just drew the line right there.
I've always thought that Kong's size and his, you know, relative size to buildings and people keeps changing throughout the movie.
You're absolutely right on that, Terry. It does keep changing. And this, once again, was people were saying, well, wait a minute, we built him on a scale of 18 inches to a foot, meaning that he'd be 18 feet high. Yet you want to make him, he said, I want to make him, for this scene, I want to make him bigger. I want to make him 24. And they all kind of looked at him like, I want to make him 24 feet. And then on occasion, he said, forget the 18, the 24. I want to make him 45. So it does keep changing. But he felt that the concept, when he got to New York, he definitely had to be bigger because of the environment. And, of course, Cooper was right. Cooper had to, you know, do a lot of fighting for things that he believed in. But inevitably, I found through the years, he was right.
Now, King Kong is really filled with a lot of bondage imagery, you know, Fay Wray and flimsy chiffon-y dresses and lingerie, yes, tied at the stake on the island or pulled out of her bed by Kong's giant arm in New York. Do you think that Cooper was intentionally playing to a kind of low-level bondage S&M kind of thing?
I don't think so. I think that he just thought this would be great material. You know, I don't think he ever gave thought to that sort of thing. He obviously wanted to use a woman, and he had not used a woman, really, in his documentaries. But he did want to use, and he did like Fay Wray. He had used her in Four Feathers, the Cooper Shudsack production of 29, and he used her in The Most Dangerous Game, which is a wonderful short story by Richard Connell that he was producing concurrently with King Kong at RKO. She was in that, and she was running around in the same jungle that she'd be shooting in the jungle during the day for The Most Dangerous Game and at night with Cooper for King Kong. And for King Kong, he wanted her in a blonde wig. She was actually a brunette, which she appears to be in The Most Dangerous Game. But he thought that the Beauty and the Beast bit, that the beauty should be a blonde. So she wore a blonde wig. And he was great friends with her and admired her, and they remained friends over the years.
The blonde was probably a better contrast to Kong's dark body.
That's right. And he said, you know, he said to Fay Wray when he first talked to her about, he says, you're going to play opposite the tallest, darkest leading man. Because she didn't really know, you know. As she got into the thing, she realized what this was going to be, but she didn't understand how it was. Because a lot of the time she was up in a tree reacting to things that hadn't really been photographed yet, or, you know, screaming in a cave or doing one thing and another. And, of course, the putting together of this film, you know, it was very difficult to know exactly what it was going to look like when it was all put together. So she had to rely on Cooper and Shodzak, and fortunately she knew them both, so that worked to her advantage.
Well, Rudy Belmer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, it's been my pleasure. And remember that big guy,
Okay. Film historian Rudy Belmer recorded in 1999 after he wrote the liner notes for a CD of the King Kong soundtrack. He provides commentary on some recently released DVDs, including The Adventures of Robin Hood, Notorious, and a special edition of Casablanca. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.